Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is a two-hour broadcast under the Zero Point logo through BBS Radio. I'm coming to you from Ottawa, Canada, and I have a co-host, James Moffitt, in Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris.
And Jim and I will be hosting the next two-hour show. Some interesting things. I thought I'd just begin by saying a little bit about what I'm doing in my life at this point and what directions my activities are taking. And then today, I wanted to begin the first part of a three-part series on mystical creation based on Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine and on what are called the stanzas of Zen. So I want to have a do a three-part series on that topic because over the past 5 to 6 months, I reread The Secret Doctrine of Blavatsky, and I've been revising my book on the work. My book on The Secret Doctrine compares the physics and metaphysics of The Secret Doctrine to ideas in modern physics and cosmology. And it was reviewed very, very positively earlier by Donna Brown from the Esoteric Quarterly, which is an online publication. She said of my book, this is the last paragraph here, she says, while portions... Oh, if you hear a flutter in the background, this is a digression. I have a little friend here who's a cockatiel, and I call her Tweet. And she's a little bit of a pest here. So as I have to kind of broach up my courage today because I realize as I give this talk on mystical creation, I'll probably have a cockatiel sitting on my head at certain points. So if you hear tweets and flutters, that's the explanation. Oh, this was Donna Brown's review of my book called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. She said, while portions of this book are not easygoing, Holmes plunges the reader into the deep places of the, occult and the new frontiers of science to come up with a lucid and provocative book. It unseals many of the secret doctrine's mysteries as it weaves the seeming opposites of spirit and science into a new synthesis. It is a must-read for those wishing to understand the complex and seemingly impenetrable world of Helena Blavatsky alongside the newest ideas of quantum theory. Holmes has created something of his own tour de force in God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. His book is destined to serve as a guidebook for all those that follow. Oh, it's a very nice, excellent review, and I feel the new. I've been revising this book over the past 5 to 6 months, and it's just, in my view, got more and more profound. And before, so I want to take the opportunity to try to give somewhat a succinct representation of what this teaching is about, like what is the mystical creation teachings of the secret doctrine. I want to do a three-part series focusing on this issue because I'm just completing the revisions of this book at this time. So I thought I would do that, and today was to be the first part of that series and then the subsequent two shows. And then once that series is completed, then I think likely after that I'll get back to having guests on the show again, and that'll include some other radio hosts and activists and resuming some of that side of my work in terms of trying to contribute to the truth movement and address the issues we're facing in our society. But today, Jim and I are just going to open, and then I'm going to by the half hour, take an hour to start going through the mystical creation teachings of the secret doctrine. And then, Jim, I thought for the last half hour, as we continued that, we could open up the phones for the last 45 minutes to a half hour to the end. And we'll give the number out at a later point. So we could take, if there were any calls, we could take them towards the end of the show.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Okay. So I've...
You have a cockatiel on your head, and I have cats crawling all over me, so it's multi-species. One of them just jumped on me. It's a multi-species show.
Yeah. Okay, so I started yesterday, Jim. I haven't been doing anything really to promote the Heart Doctrine book since it's been published, because I've been trying to complete this other writing on the secret doctrine. Sometimes that gets so heavy, and I get bogged down in it and have a hard time getting much done. Fortunately, I've had a kind of impetus lately to get going again at it. Did you see the graphic I sent you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Wasn't that nicely done, eh?
Yeah.
That's a lady in Croatia who is helping to do some of the illustrations and graphics for God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, which was a real problem for me because a number of them are from the Scientific American magazine.
Right.
And I tried previously to contact them to get permissions to use some of their images, but they never got back to me, and they seem pretty closed off, so it's like I've needed to come up with new graphics for the book, and then this lady is kind of producing these really excellent images.
Yeah, where did you, how did you get in touch with her, or how did she get in touch with you?
Well, actually, she ordered two books, a copy of The Heart Doctrine and Psychological Illusions on Gurdjieff.
Oh, okay, wow.
Yeah, and she was reading Gurdjieff's Life is Real Only Then When I Am.
Yeah.
And so she's one who I ended up sending Psychological Illusions and The Slugs on Gurdjieff off to her on a DVD, so she may help me set those books up to produce them as publications. Yeah, it's so nice to see my work in this format. Hey, Jim, it gives me distance on it. It's like I can read my own book, and it's like it's someone else's almost, you know?
Yeah, it's definitely different reading it in this format. I haven't read a lot, but I've been rereading it, because I just read it a while ago, but I wanted to reread it again, because I'm writing about it, so it's, you know... It's when you're writing about something, you really have to know what you're writing about if you want to do it justice. So it's been a good opportunity for me to get back into reading the book again. And there's just so much material. The same thing really holds true that Donna Brown said about God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, about the Heart Doctrine, is you can read it and reread it and reread it, and there's tons of interesting material. And, I mean... over the years, I think, like, I didn't really know very much about Kabbalah, and I still don't. I mean, I wouldn't feel qualified to lecture anybody on it, but I've grasped at least some of the essential ideas, and it ties in with your topic today about the metaphysics and physics of creation and Blavatsky's work, because it's all along the same lines, and I mean, certainly Kabbalistic influences in her teaching, and certainly consistent with Kabbalistic teaching. So I found that part very interesting in the Heart Doctrine, like just at the beginning when you talk about some of the Kabbalistic ideas.
Yeah, it's so profound. Like, the Tree of Life is this totally beautiful kind of symbol, deep symbol, eh? And yeah, it's unbelievable. Like, like how Gurdjieff says that certain symbols are the medium of the higher intellectual center. Like the Kabbalistic Tree of Life as an image, in a way it depicts ideas that involve like higher faculties of mind. That's what it's kind of, represents. It's a tool. Like it's and the Tree of Life, just to explain a little bit of it for listeners, like, I should do a whole show on the Tree of Life, actually, sometime. I'd like to do that. It's 10 sephira, and it's or spheres or circles, or those are said to be emanations. And there are three supernals represented as a triangle in the higher world. Those supernals, they're beyond material existence. And then you might imagine under those three spheres a wiggly line going across, and that's the abyss. So the three supernals are above the abyss. The abyss is like the emptiness or when before creation. And then below the three supernals, you have seven spheres, or sephira. And those seven sephira are all said to be emanations out of the divine mother, or a bana. She gives birth to the seven lower sephira. So the Kabbalistic tree represents the law of three in the supernal realm, and then the law of seven in the realm below. And you add those together and you have ten. So this tree of life is actually a depiction of the structure of existence and the idea of how there are different interpenetrating planes of existence. So the tree of life is said in the Bible, it's in the Garden of Eden, there are said to be two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil, which is dualistic. But whereas the tree of life is the knowledge of the laws of three and seven, whereas the tree of knowledge of good and evil is dualistic. And it is said that the tree of life is hidden in the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So the idea of the tree of life, it's a profound symbol that represents these principles of mystical creation, the laws of three and seven, which it's funny, AJ, most people have no idea that even that some people even believe that such things, that there are kind of these divine principles of creation. Like,
well, yeah, and definitely they don't associate it with most people with their understanding of mysticism. That's sort of what's always missing in any most people's accounts and references to mysticism is the idea that there's an intellectual content to it, and that not only is it an intellectual content, but there's a profound intellectual content to it. And like anything else, almost everything in mystical and esoteric teachings can be taken on a variety of different levels. And the more you know and the more you understand, the deeper you can, the deeper your understanding and knowledge of these symbols and myths can be, because they embody so much, but you have to have a certain preparation in order to be able to decode or interpret them. So as you say, the tree of life is actually a very profound diagram of the structure of creation, but you know, you could look at it and just see a bunch of lines with some names in them, you know. So
it depends
on your understanding. It really does. So
yeah, absolutely. And we have to cultivate our knowledge of mystical symbols and numerology, like numbers study. Like, yeah, how different numbers have, like numbers in mystical teachings, they're not just as if on the number line, a continuous number line, well, where you go from one to two to three to four, like the numbers have other significance in terms of geometry and symbols and dimensions and things like that. So there's a whole esoteric number study, within the educational system you never considered, at least in my experience, I was never exposed to such a line of thinking. As the idea that there are kind of principles of mystical creation, like the laws of three and seven. The laws of three and seven, and it's not like it's just in one, the secret doctrine. It's in Gurdjieff, it's in Kabbalah, it's in Sufi teachings, it's in the Vedas, it's in Tibetan Buddhism of the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, we have these same principles articulated in these different traditions. So that's really profound. I was thinking, before starting into the mystical creation, I just wanted to mention a last thing. So, in terms of, I'm going to start promoting the Heart Doctrine, and I've contacted a few BBS hosts and a few at RBN, which is another network, Truth Network, that I listen to, and I want to send out copies of the Heart Doctrine to about a dozen people, I hope, you know, in different areas, and try to do some promotion of it. Because I think it's really valuable for someone who interviews me a bit to see the scholarship of the book. You know, because often, you know, I can talk, Jim, about like how, the Heart Doctrine, and it sounds so simple, and you think that it's, well, that's nice, kind of, you know, he thinks consciousness comes from the heart. Well, that's a nice idea. It's a feely-good idea. But you don't realize, no, it's not just that. Like, there's this whole higher dimensional science as to what mystics say about the heart, about the zimzum contraction and the emptiness in the center of the heart, and the light within the heart, and the heart is a higher dimensional space, and the powers, the cities that develop with the awakening of the heart, and all these mysteries of the heart. Like, it's not just, oh yeah, the Heart Doctrine, that sounds nice. It's so much more deeper. And yeah, that's why I find like the Heart Doctrine book, it's a treasury of kind of mystical literature in a way.
Yeah, I mean, there's very many different aspects in to the content of the book, but if nothing else, if you were to read that book, I think one of the things that in terms of scholarship that would be very arresting to most people is to realize that the Heart Doctrine is something that is, as you said, it's articulated in all these different traditions. And over again, there are these references, which I think even if people are aware of them, they would tend to take them metaphorically and not realize, no, they don't mean this metaphorically, they mean this literally, that consciousness and the self are seated in the heart, and that there's this infinitesimally small point within the heart which is rooted into the higher dimensions, and that these are very profound ideas. But one thing for me, like, even though I had a background in mystical and esoteric teachings and know a fair amount about it, I had no idea that until you started compiling this and over the years added more and more references, I didn't realize that this was in all these teachings, that these ideas are repeated over and over and over again. It's quite amazing, actually.
Yeah, and it, like, you find among those ideas repeated through these different sources, one is like the Heart Doctrine, and the other is these principles of mystical creation, like the laws of 3 and 7. Yeah. And then the third area is the idea of zero points, that cosmoses have a kind of point source or origin or center. And that concept is in, like, even in Kabbalistic creation, in the beginning, kind of before the beginning in Kabbalah, you have the threefold nature of the three supernals, Ein Sof, Hour, which represent the absolute nothingness, the infinite plenum, and the infinite light that fills the infinite all. So it's like that threefold aspect of nothingness. And those Ein Sof Hour, that's all part of negative existence. So it's kind of beyond, when creation happens then in Kabbalah, the first point that is established is a point, a point source. So you have that zero point concept and in Kabbalah, and then you have it in the Vedic teachings. They have bindi points. So it's an archaic idea. You find it in Sufism, the idea there's a divine spark in the human being. You find it in Gnosticism, that there's a divine spark. It's in Kabbalah as a spark of holiness that kind of comes down out of higher dimensions and then is anchored into the heart. Yeah, it all, as you study the esoteric teachings, they all fit together more and more. It's like having certain keys to unveiling the mysteries, I think. and Blavatsky provides and Gurdjieff provides certain keys.
Yeah, it's like after studying Gurdjieff, I always thought like that he talks about that there is what he calls the ray of creation is that there's gradation of different world orders which are of different densities of materiality and different levels of consciousness that from a unity a creation descends, so there's this descending curve which is something that's not recognized in modern science and modern thought, and so that you have this stepping down of world orders and eventually manifesting on the material plane that we live in and which we detect through our senses. And I always thought, there's this unity that underlies everything, but then, that's an interesting thing when you talk about in Kabbalah, about what is the concept of nothingness, and that at the heart of everything there's this nothingness. Now, that's a part I didn't really understand until I started reading Kabbalistic teachings, is that there's a unity, but there's a nothingness behind the unity. And then the idea of the Zimzum contraction was funny because I thought we were going to end up talking about this somehow today. I had this premonition that we were going to end up talking about this, but that there's this withdrawal of God's will or spirit or I'm not sure exactly how you would describe it, but
I would say partly of the infinite potencies latent in the plenum. So there's an emptiness instead of the fullness of the plenum.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so that's kind of what withdraws, the infinity.
It's like how
an infinite being has to allow a finite being to come into existence.
Yeah, because
yeah, it has to kind of withdraw.
In order to create the space for something to manifest, because it already
For individuation in a way. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful concept.
Yeah. Now, what you were talking about before is you started out and you're talking about the points, and you're talking about Kabbalah and about the point source of creation, and then sort of as you were talking about it, you started talking about it in terms of human beings, and that I think is again. In your work, especially, I don't know of anybody else who really addresses this, but this idea that there's a zero-point origin which accounts for both material worlds or creation, like the universe, but also for us as individual human beings. So this is a very profound idea. Again, it's consistent with the esoteric maxim that man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, or as above, so below. The same laws that apply on the cosmological level apply on the psychological level. That's something that, in studying Gurdjieff originally in the Fourth Way teaching, that's something that I didn't really understand, but I couldn't reject because I really thought his psychological teaching was so profound. It just struck me as being so profound. But his idea that really psychology and cosmology are complementary sciences, and you can't really talk about one without talking about the other, that they're integrally related, and in order to study ourselves in the world, we have to study some things are more readily observable and easily interpreted in terms of the cosmos, and some things on a psychological level. And I think that's the kind of dialectic that you go through in a mystical and esoterical perspective, which is completely missing in modern science, which tends to be much more fractionated and differentiated in terms of specialization, and within the material mechanistic paradigm which dominates modern science, you don't see those connections. But I think that's the most profound aspect, in a way, of the whole esoteric perspective, mystical perspective on the study of consciousness. Is consciousness is that which relates the psychology to cosmology and cosmology to psychology. And in your book, with the heart doctrine, that's what you're able to establish, I think, very well, is this is a different way of thinking about everything, and that there's all sorts of compelling evidence to suggest that we should study these things and entertain these as serious scientific hypotheses, and all sorts ideas arise when you adopt that perspective, which show how certain mysteries aren't so mysterious once you assume that perspective.
Yeah, it's a whole alternative way of understanding it. It leads to a revision of all usual thought, in a way. It really does, as a alternative model of the nature and structure of human existence. And it's kind of showing how these, what religious and mystical teachings have taught, like about the heart and God and knowing God and being enlightened and awakening in the heart and God's love as a cosmic force, all these kinds of ideas, like, there's a reality to these. I lost my train of thought a little bit.
I mean, one other thing I was just going to say, when you're talking about how ancient these ideas about zero points and point source singularities, and I mean, yet in 20th century science, this is the view that scientists and physicists have come to, and cosmologists, about the origin and nature of the universe, is that everything was concentrated in this point, and there was a random fluctuation in the quantum vacuum, which brought about the Big Bang. But I mean, it's amazing that, as you know, that these ideas have been around for thousands of years in the esoteric and mystical traditions, and yet modern scientists think that they developed these ideas. You know, they discovered them, but they haven't. I mean, and it really begs the question, like, how is this possible? You know, that these ideas have been around. How did these people know this? I mean, because clearly they knew it. They weren't just talking off the top of their heads. They had a very profound understanding of these dynamics and put forward these ideas, and clearly didn't mean them metaphorically. They meant them literally. This is a huge gap in modern knowledge, like this basic ignorance, as you say, like of these ideas, and people not understanding that such things as, like, the tree of life exist, and that the tree of life is actually a profound diagram of the structure and essence of creation, and just these very profound concepts that recur throughout these teachings. A very, very it overturns all these ridiculous ideas that people have about the nature of knowledge and knowing. I think, you know, that there's a real profound ignorance about the history of human beings and attempts to understand themselves, and the importance of the mystical and esoteric teachings in addressing those questions.
Yeah, things like revelations and insights and things like this that have aided the progression of science, and on how those things are. I remember the fellow who developed the idea of vacuum genesis, creation out of the universe, out of nothingness, and it was revealed to him in a dream. Okay, and he had this kind of like wild dream where he experienced this as kind of a reality, and then it helped him formulate what, you know, the concept of vacuum genesis. Okay, and so, but he didn't kind of, well, but there is nothing mystical to it, kind of, even though it was revealed to him through direct experience in a way. But he wouldn't think that anything mystical about it. He would just think that, well, he doesn't really say, you know, he doesn't consider that but that's what Blavatsky's saying, is that she describes mystics as like the daring explorers who develop the higher faculties of mind and so can understand or penetrate the nominal realm that underlies and sustains the phenomenal realm, so that they can, in a way, explore these realms directly, so that it is, in a way, it is revealed teachings and knowledge revealed in higher states, more objective states of consciousness. And also, we'll see when we come to this secret doctrine in a few minutes, that, like her, what Blavatsky says about the origins of the stanzas of Zen, which in a way come down to us from divine beings. So that's an aspect of the esoteric tradition, that there's higher knowledge that is brought down to us from more highly spiritually evolved, or in this case, divine beings, is what Blavatsky claims is the origins of the stanzas of Zen. So the idea that there are these elevated beings that bring knowledge down to humankind. Gurdjieff calls them sacred messengers, I think, in Beelzebub's Tales. Okay, so just to finish up, so I am beginning to send out some copies of the Heart Doctrine, and then we'll begin in a few moments to go through the Secret Doctrine and Mystical Creation series, and then after this series of 3 weeks, then we'll probably go back to having a format with guests again or having call-ins and such. Okay, so where are we, Jim? Okay, so
did you want to talk about creation?
Why don't we do that? And I'm going to try to start a little bit formally again, just so that that I can kind of splice the tape and maybe put together a kind of 3-hour lecture on mystical creation. So I'll just step back and introduce myself just so it could stand alone. This is Christopher Holmes, and I would like to present a 3-part series on mystical creation. And these lectures are based on The Secret Doctrine of H.P. Blavatsky, which was published in 1888. Blavatsky is often regarded as the grandmother of Western occultism. The Secret Doctrine is this massive 2-volume set. The first is called Cosmogenesis, so meaning cosmos, or the world, and genesis, it means the creation of. So Cosmogenesis deals with the creation and evolution of the universe, according to Blavatsky's archaic teachings. And Volume 2 deals with Anthropogenesis, which is the history of the creation and evolution of humankind on the planet Earth and more broadly within the solar system and universe. Manly Hall, a famous occult scholar and Mason, described the Secret Doctrine as undoubtedly the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world. And it's a massive, almost incomprehensible book. Each of them are 600 to 700 pages, each volume. And it's very difficult material. I began to study these over 25 years ago, and through the years, one can grasp more and more, and some of the mysteries that are revealed, I feel, they have been for myself anyway through the years. And there's still so much more within the Secret Doctrine that I still don't understand. So I'd like to explain the principles of mystical creation as elaborated within the Secret Doctrine. Now, the Secret Doctrine are actually based on an archaic manuscript which Blavatsky claimed to have possession of at some point. And this was called the Book of Zan, spelled D-Z-Y-A-N. And I'm not sure of the pronunciation since I learned these things myself. And if I was subject to a more formal theosophical education, they may pronounce that term differently. But I'm used to saying the Book of Zan, D-Z-Y-A-N. Blavatsky says that the Book of Zan is utterly unknown to our philologists, or at any rate was never heard of by them under its present name. So, apart from Blavatsky's scholarship, there doesn't seem, to my knowledge, to be other writings on the Book of Zan or other people who present these stanzas. The stanzas are described as, quote, the heart of the sacred books of Qi-Ti, once known only to Tibetan mystics. And Blavatsky claims that the stanzas of Zan are derived from, quote, the words of the divine beings who dictated it to the sons of light in Central Asia at the very beginning of the fifth hour race. Now, according to Theosophy and Blavatsky's teachings, that human existence, there are rounds. A cycle of existence has seven rounds, and each round has seven races, and each race has seven root races. Everything is sevenfold in terms of cycles of creation and time and life. And Blavatsky says that we are currently on the fourth, in the fourth cycle, or on the fourth globe. And on the fourth globe, we are the fifth root race. Okay, and we're just the beginning. She said the Atlanteans, the end of Atlantis, was the fourth root race. And then ours was subsequent to the sinking of Atlantis. She's saying that there were divine beings who dictated this higher knowledge to the sons of light in Central Asia at the very beginning of the fifth hour race. So we're said to be the fifth root race on the fourth round. Okay, so the secret doctrine then is based on these stanzas of Zan. And there are seven stanzas, and what the stanzas depict is the processes of cosmic evolution. And so what I would like to attempt to do is go through these stanzas and reading them and then elaborating upon them. Oh, and just to introduce my co-host for people who may just be picking up this series, Jim Moffat is with me. Jim, do you want to just say hello again? And
okay, hello again.
Just so someone doesn't want to, oh, where did he come from? okay, so any comments? That's a very interesting, a pretty exaggerated claim. One would think, hey, what, these stanzas come from divine beings? But then the most amazing kind of poetic, mystical stanzas, really, they're quite beautiful. They're extraordinary. It's... Go ahead, Jim.
Well, just again, and this refers to something that we spoke of earlier, but again, it's when you read them, you can certainly, as you say, they're very poetic and they're very there's something very appealing about them. But the more that you understand and the more you probe and try to interpret what's being said there, the more profound they become, and the more you realize how incredibly concise and coherent they are, and that they're really describing something quite wonderful. As a writer, what I see in them is that they're so concise and so coherent. That's what I see in them. And as you say, they're very poetic also.
Yeah, that's an amazing comment. That's so true. Like, as you understand them more and more, like, it's so brilliant and concise. Yeah. And it's interesting. If in the beginning of The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky at one point gives the stanzas, seven of them, which run about 15 pages or so, and then she takes like 600 pages to try to explain them, and still doesn't explain them completely, but gives many insights. But when at the beginning of The Secret Doctrine, she gives the stanzas, and then at the end of them, she put in this little note, and she says, "Thus ends this portion of the archaic narrative, dark, confused, almost incomprehensive. An attempt will now be made to throw light into this darkness, to make sense out of this apparent nonsense." Which is, hey, Jim, is like exactly what you were saying. Like, you hear him the first time and, you know, it's kind of makes a little bit of sense or something, but you're completely lost. But then over time, you learn the language and you learn the characters, and it just becomes more and more illuminating, and you see the clarity and profound nature of the stanzas.
Yeah, and again, it's like it's the parallel is with almost all sacred literature is, you know, something like Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. It's allusive. There's always an allusion to a variety of other meanings, so that things are condensed and put into very concise forms, but they generally have multiple meanings and multiple levels of interpretation. And that's the true genius of things. When you as you begin to understand them, you realize, oh my God, there's so much in this, what you originally thought was apparently, you know, just something, some statement, and you realize, no, this is very profound. Like, there's more and more to it. That's like, it's like it's the layers of an onion. You keep peeling it back, and there's, you know, there's another layer of meaning to it all.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so, well, then what we'll do is I'll begin with stanza one, and I'll sometimes explain some basics before I give the verses, or I'll give a verse and then try to elaborate a little bit on its content. Now, the first stanza of Zan, it has 9 verses, and it all depicts a period before creation even begins. It depicts what Blavatsky refers to as the periods of the dark nights of Brahma, when creation is all absorbed in non-being. In modern physics, this would be the quantum vacuum before creation occurred. Okay, so the first stanza of Zan is describing what existed before existence came into existence, before physical existence came into existence, during the nights of Brahma. Okay, so stanza one says, the eternal parent, wrapped in her ever-invisible robes, had slumbered once again for 7 eternities. Okay, so firstly, the eternal parent. And what is the eternal parent for Blavatsky and in the Secret Doctrine is what's called the eternal parent space. And Blavatsky says the eternal parent space is sevenfold, has 7 skins. Okay, she refers to it often as a 7-skinned eternal parent space. Or the great sea is said to be 7 cubits deep. Okay, the great sea refers to the chaos or the waters of space. Okay, and they're said to be 7 cubits or measures deep. Okay, so the idea that in modern physics, what this line is actually saying, the eternal parent wrapped in her ever-invisible robes had slumbered once again for 7 eternities. What it actually suggests in modern terms is that the existence of a 7-dimensional hyperspace. See, the eternal parent space is a space beyond the manifested 4-dimensional space-time continuum. It is the root principle. It's a higher dimensional space, the eternal parent space, which over time gives birth to infinite numbers of universes and worlds, which are created out of this hyperspace, the parent space. So our universe, in Blavatsky's teaching, is regarded just as one created universe out of a process that goes on infinitely. Okay, so the eternal parent is really hyperspace, 7-dimensional hyperspace. Okay, so Blavatsky is saying the sevenfoldness of existence is, in fact, pre-existent in non-existence, in a sense. That even in this hyperspace, that sevenfoldness is inherent. So when creation then occurs out of hyperspace, because the hyperspace is sevenfold, then when the created worlds are created, they also are sevenfold. As above, so below. It's the same pattern of creation. In the stanzas of Zan, we'll see later, they state at one point, 7 inside, 7 outside. You see, sevenfoldness of the parent space or hyperspace. So when creation happens, there's sevenfold dimensions of existence. Okay, so that's the first stanza, that this eternal parent is wrapped in her ever-invisible robes and had slumbered once again for seven eternities. Now, here, this is depicting the period just before creation is initiated. So it's saying that the eternal parent, the hyperspace, has been unmanifested or existing in her invisible robes for seven eternities. Those are the seven nights of Brahma. So in the beginning of the stanzas, it's like it's dawning, the end is coming of these seven nights of Brahma, and creation is about to occur. So that's all depicted in patterns of creation and dissolution of universes always are based on the principle of the law of seven, the sevenfoldness. Okay, so we have seven nights of Brahma, which are then followed by 7 days of Brahma. And then after 7 days of Brahma, according to the Blavatsky, all of the being is withdrawn again into non-being. Everything returns again to the quantum vacuum. And then there's another period of rest or non-manifestation until another cycle begins. Okay, stanza two. Time was not, for it lay asleep in the infinite bosom of duration. So she's saying that time is something only that arises when you have a created universe. Otherwise, there's this kind of infinite duration, which is different than the linear flow of time. Verse 3, universal mind was not, for there were no ahi to contain it. Now we'll see that when creation, according to the secret doctrine, the patterns of creation is a manifestation of universal mind. Okay, this higher realm of mind, of the mind of God in a sense, but we'll use other terms later. So the creation is a manifestation of higher mind. And she says at this point there were no ahi to contain it. An ahi is spelled A-H-H-I. It's an odd Tibetan term. But what that means in essentially are divine or celestial or spiritual beings, like intelligences. So she's saying that before creation, there were no spiritual or divine intelligences to contain universal mind. Verse 4 says, the seven ways to bliss were not. The great causes of misery were not. For there was no one to produce and get ensnared by them. So here what she's saying the different things which are not. Okay, the seven ways to bliss were not. Okay, now the fact that she's saying they are not in a way implies that they are, that they in a way are already pre-existent, but they're unmanifest. But somehow the fact that there's seven ways to bliss, when creation happens, those will be made manifest. So even in the non-being, those seven ways to bliss were somehow inherent. Okay, verse 5, she says, darkness alone filled the boundless all, for father, mother, and son were once more one. And the sun had not awakened yet for the new wheel and his pilgrimage thereon. So, Blavatsky sees darkness. Darkness, in a way, is absolute light. Okay, that darkness is the highest form, metaphysically, of light. It's similar in the book of Genesis, when in the beginning we have the darkness upon the face of the deep. The earth was empty and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Yeah, the darkness, in a way, is the ultimate source. You see, that's the darkness represents what exists in negative existence, okay, before it gives rise to positive existence. So darkness is seen metaphorically as a form of absolute light, and it's containing light within itself. And then when creation happens here, we'll see there's a phrase, a stanza say, darkness radiates light. Okay, so that the ray of light that instigates the process of creation emerges out of the darkness. Okay, so this stanza said, darkness alone filled the boundless all. And then for father, mother, and son were once more one. And the son had not awakened yet for the new wheel and his pilgrimage thereon. So, who is the son? And I'd like to digress for a moment here. It's as Jim and I were talking about earlier in mystical teachings, there's this idea of the microcosm embodying the same principles of creation as embodied in the macrocosm. Okay, that a human being is made in the image of God or in the image of the universe. So when here Blavatsky's talking about a son, who is this son? Well, you could take the son to be a universe, a created universe that emerges out of the quantum vacuum. That is a son. And on a different level, a son could be a human being with a divine source emanation within them. So that could be a son. See, so Blavatsky explains that the formula of the secret doctrine can be applied on all these different levels. So when we study the secret doctrine to understand creation, in a way, the same line of thinking is also applied to understand ourselves, that these are our roots. Okay? So I would say, like Blavatsky's here depicting how creation emerges out of nothingness and how before creation there was this infinite darkness. Well, I would say, as a consciousness researcher, I would agree with the Sufi who said, not since God brought man out of nothingness has he ceased to be a traveler. Okay, so in a way, the mystical concept is that human beings, in a way, we also emerge out of this nothingness. And as the Sufi quote says, not since then have we ceased to be a traveler. And that's the idea. Blavatsky says when a universe emerges out of hyperspace, it becomes a sun, like the created sun becomes a world in itself, and it begins a pilgrimage. So kind of going out into the world and eventually returning again to the root principles of creation. Now, Blavatsky really has an astonishing view of the process of creation. Imagine beginning with absolute nothingness and darkness and emptiness, and then there's a point source origin, and the cosmos emerges from a point source, and it expands within without, like the budding of a lotus, and expanding space-time continuum. And then Blavatsky says eventually that space-time continuum will go into another phase, and it will begin to contract, and that it will eventually all contract back to once again the zero point, and then once again back into the darkness of non-being. Now, this is a beautifully symmetrical conception of the creation and dissolution of universes or worlds or suns out of nothingness. Isn't that beautiful, Tim?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, exactly.
It makes so much sense. I mean, it's amazing in modern science. They believe the universe emerged from a point source out of the quantum vacuum, which is described as paradoxically the void and plenum. And they believe if the universe ever contracts back, according to the law of gravity, it could collapse back to a black hole into a dreaded singularity and back into the quantum vacuum. So all these ideas that Blavatsky was explaining in 1888 anticipated modern concepts by over a century.
Yeah, and she talks about broken symmetries also, and I mean, there's many parallels between what she says. And as I said, I mean, when you were talking earlier about Kabbalistic teachings and about, you know, there's that quote that we've used from Jonathan Cott when he was interviewing Rabbi Lawrence Kushner, and Kushner says, you know, in the 14th century, the Kabbalists believed that, you know, that the universe had emerged out of a single point, you know? I mean, 14th century.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And it's,
yes,
you know,
a single point of supernal lux.
Yeah. I mean, it's precisely what modern science has come to in its understanding. It's even older than that. Like, I mean, it's thousands of years old in the Vedas and other traditions, too. So it's these ideas are, I mean, and it's not like that these people are, again, is that they're not fumbling towards something. These people know what they're talking about. They, you know, they have the same kind of sense of authority that you get with science, is that people have based these things empirically. They understand these things. Now, the question is, how do they do that? You know, like, that's what's so interesting. But
they're just so profound verses. It's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like, it doesn't seem like a product of ordinary kind of rational scientists thinking or philosophizing. It's just something. It's of a different character in a way.
And I think that's always that's the thing that's always stood out to me since I began studying mystical and esoteric teachings. That there are certain, and even within the mystical and esoteric traditions, there are certain texts and certain speeches where people expound on ideas in which there's something qualitatively different, and there's a sense of authority about things that really stands apart from everything else. And as I'd say that, as I say, there are gradations within the mystical traditions where, like, some of the speeches that Gurdjieff makes in Search of the Miraculous just struck me when I first read them as being so qualitatively different from anything else I'd ever read that I just sort of knew that this is true. I mean, I would say that the same about Blavatsky, about the stanzas, you know, and another sacred literature, like when you read Patanjali's yogic aphorisms. I mean, there are many different examples of this, and there's an intelligence to it that if you're open-minded about it at all, it's just so striking if you're curious about things, you can't help but be interested in it.
And that is the tradition of these teachings. In a way, they're revealed and esoteric teachings. They're not teachings that people kind of arrived at in an empirical way. They're brought down or revealed to us.
I mean, but in a sense, it is empirical in this sense that people have studied themselves or developed themselves often in certain ways, which has made them receptive to that which is already sort of there, and then it's revealed to them. So, I mean, it's revealed knowledge in a sense which is very different. But again, even what you were pointing out when you were talking earlier about the guy, you know, talking about the scientist earlier, and something coming to him in the dream, this is the same thing as, like, you know, how do people, what's the nature of scientific creativity and insight, you know? I mean, much of it, the history of it is involves equally mysterious processes where people just sort of see things or you know, it just comes to them. I mean, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Einstein worked out the special theory of relativity in a relatively brief period of time. Of course, he had to go through an enormous amount of preparation, but it sort of came to him. Now, how did that actually happen? We don't really understand, even, you know, with respect to ordinary thought, like what really great creative insights are composed of. I mean, the other example, is like Descartes having these dreams where these angels came and spoke to him, where he realized the mathematical nature of reality. He had this series of profound dreams. You know, there's all sorts of examples of this in science. So again,
yeah, the inventors of the double helix and how they had the kind of mystical dream of a snake swallowing its own tail and archaic symbolism.
Yeah, was it the Kekulé or the benzene, the structure of the benzene atom? I think he had a dream.
I
think that's who it was. But yeah, I mean, there are many examples. But to get back to the point, though, it's like, in a way, I'd say in some cases, I think these things are in a very real sense, they are empirical because they're based on a series of observations, but then that there's this revealed aspect to it, it's not something that's coming out of people's minds so much as it is something that's their minds are being opened up so that they can actually allow it to come to them, and it does come from these things do come from higher dimensional sources, higher levels of intelligence, I would say.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll come back, and I'll just pick up again. We're in stanza 1, verse 6. The seven sublime lords and the seven truths had ceased to be. Now here, see, what's being said is like paradoxical in a way, because she's saying the seven sublime lords had ceased to be, but really, what the verses tell us is the seven sublime lords are latent in non-being, that they are existent in pre-existence, but just unmanifested. So although the seven sublime lords had ceased to be, their potency and nature is inherent to the nothingness even before creation happens. And the universe, the sun of necessity, was immersed in paranishpana. And I'm not sure what that means, but I think it means in formless blissfulness. To be outbreathed by that which is and yet is not. Okay, so this is very important. Outbreathed. Now, we'll see that there are two essential characters, well, there's more than that, but two for the moment. The eternal parent space, we introduced in verse 1, the eternal parent space. And then the other character is what Blavatsky calls the ceaseless breath. Okay, and Blavatsky says there's this like ceaseless breath, which it never ceases. It's like if you went into the quantum vacuum. In modern physics, they call it the quantum jitters. That if you get down to 0 point levels, like in the quantum vacuum, it's never still. There's this like continuous violent kind of perturbations and activity within the nothingness. And Blavatsky calls it the ceaseless breath. Now, the eternal parent space represents the feminine principle, okay, the roots of matter in the feminine parent space. And the ceaseless breath represents the masculine or spiritual principle. So the parent space and the ceaseless breath represent the roots for matter and spirit. Okay, so Blavatsky's, In this verse, it said everything was immersed in formless blissfulness, to be outbreathed by that which is and yet is not. So outbreathed. So Blavatsky saying, even before creation happened, there's this ceaseless breath or activity in the nothingness. But when she says, when creation happens, that ceaseless breath first exhales, and the out-breathing is what gives rise and creates the universe. And she says, she describes the seven cycles of expansion first, is the seven modifications of the ceaseless breath. And when the universe is created, she says, it expands when the breath of the Father is upon it. So So it's like creation. The first cycle, part of the cycle, is the breath of the Father. The world is outbreathed and created. And see, in all mystical traditions, like, the breath is how we are ensouled through spirit. In Kabbalah, there are said to be five levels to the human soul, and each of these is connected to the breath, in different levels of the breath in the human being, which are all variations on this fundamental ceaseless breath that existed even before creation happened. So these are Blavatsky's two major cosmic characters, the eternal parent space and the ceaseless breath. Okay, and now what's profound about these is we can look at the book of Genesis. And let's just take the first few verses of Genesis. It says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. So I would say, like, in a way, what that's telling us, like, here's our first triunity. God, heaven, and earth. Like, that's a triunity. And that's telling us God creates a spiritual world above and a material world below. So in a way, there's God that creates a heaven and the earth, spiritual and material worlds. That's kind of the first triunity. Okay, and in the books of Genesis, okay, and the earth was empty and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Okay, so this again, see this, the book of Genesis is saying the same thing as the stanzas of Dan. It's saying the earth was empty and void. It's like there was no forms. There was nothing. The earth was empty and void. Everything was absorbed in non-being. There was a voidness, emptiness. See, in a way, the book of Genesis anticipates the modern idea of vacuum Genesis, that once upon a time, there was nothing that existed. Everything was absorbed in the nothingness. And that's actually suggested by the first verses of the book of Genesis. Okay, so the earth was empty and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Well, see, again, the darkness, just like Blavatsky's saying, the darkness, and the darkness is like this infinite metaphysical light that's then the source of light. And it was upon the face of the deep. What is the deep? Well, in Blavatsky, the deep is the eternal parent space. Okay, well, also referred to as the great sea, S-E-A, like ocean, or the ocean of infinite ocean of energies and possibilities, or it's also referred to as the chaos. The chaos is the divine mother principle embodied in space, which is like this great sea or the deep. Okay, and then in the book of Genesis, it says, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the... Oh, no, what is... And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the deep? Do you recall, too? I'm blanking a little bit. In the beginning, God created heaven and the earth, and the earth was empty and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. That's what it is. See, the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. So again, see, the book of Genesis is saying what Blavatsky's saying. Okay, it says the Spirit of God. Now, spiritus is related to breath. Also, spiritus. Okay, so it's a spirit. It's a ceaseless breath. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And see, the waters is this archaic symbol for the divine mother parent space. So in the book of Genesis, we have the same cast of characters as Blavatsky has in The Secret Doctrine. We have the kind of Spirit of God or the ceaseless breath, and we have the divine mother represented by the great sea or the parent space or the waters of space or the deep. It's amazing, hey, Jim. I remember like 30 years ago trying to read the book of Genesis. It's like I could never get by the first chapter. Because I was like, I couldn't, you know, I knew there was more to it. It's like all my life, I couldn't get past chapter one of the book of Genesis. Wow. To understand the mystery teaching. And it's like the more you learn, it's like in the Bible, those verses have like such profound teaching that people just don't grasp. Like, I've never met a Christian who understood the first three verses of Genesis, in a way.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's all like that. I mean, and I never, you know, I went to Sunday school and studied the New Testament and everything, and until I read Maurice Nichols' book, The New Man, I never realized that there was a whole other level of interpreting these things, and that it was referring to something quite different from what I was taught and what most people interpret as this means. When it comes to spirit, though, the Greek word pneuma is the same root for spirit and breath. Eh? Like it's the same thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's, I mean, that's perfectly compatible with what you're talking about, because it's like when the ceaseless eternal breath is sort of like the dynamic movement of spirit, I would say. Like, I mean, or I
yes.
think you could draw that conclusion, you know, that this is what spirit is. Is this spirit is this like dynamic intelligence dynamic being the critical word, like it's always in movement, as you say, like, and if you get down at the quantum vacuum level, there's always this agitation, this perturbation of everything, that there's no stillness, and I mean, it's entirely consistent. That's as you say,
yeah.
And you can read in Genesis, like you can read like a whole different level into things that most people just don't see, you know. And I mean, like even just like God created the heaven and the earth, like, you know, that's where like the perspective of having the law of three, okay, so you have God.
Yeah.
And then you have heaven above, and like that's what we're always told, there's heaven above and earth below, right? But
yeah.
So we take that kind of literally, fundamentally, like heaven is in the sky above us and earth is below. But it's the idea of the higher is the spiritual world, and the lower is the material plane. Now that's a completely different and profoundly different interpretation of a very simple couple of words in the Bible, you know, like, and then God, like God is like, is this third force, which is invisible in this, like God created the heaven and the earth. Okay.
Yeah, and it's like the heaven and the earth, like the dual nature is inherent to the God.
Yeah,
but the
yeah.
God includes something more, like the third beyond heaven and earth.
Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah. It's like this profound idea of this triunity.
Yeah, very, very, very different. And I mean, you can do that with almost any esoteric teaching, is that once you begin to understand it, you can start to see its applicability to all these sacred literatures, that, and you can see how, like, oh, well, you know, I can understand these things literally and fundamentally, and, you know, people will make fun of that interpretation, but that doesn't exhaust the interpretations of the scripture, and I think it doesn't really refer to what the people who wrote it really meant. I think this is much closer to what they intended to say. Again, it's very interesting that it's what you put into these things. The more effort you make to understand them, the more profound they become. That's what's so amazingly rewarding about all this. Eh? It's like so inspiring about it. Inspire, you know, like to breathe
inspiration,
in.
Yeah, inspiration, yeah, to breathe, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing, just in passing, it's like, also, if you take that verse from Genesis, it says, the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. Even, and if a person knows fundamentals of magic, kind of, like, spirit represents the element fire, and that's represented by an upward-turned triangle. Oops, my bird just is on my, that is on my telephone here. I gotta move her. Go on. Hey, tweet. Did you hear her fly? Oh, there is, she tweeted. Okay. So the Spirit of God, that would be represented by an upward-turned triangle, moved upon the face of the waters. And the symbol in magic for waters is a downward-turned triangle. So if the Spirit of God moving upon the face of the waters, you can represent as a Star of David, with an overlapping triangles representing spirit and waters. And then in the book of Genesis, and then God says, let there be light. And you might imagine that light establishing a point of light in the center of that Star of David. And this idea of the central point within the Star of David is a profound mystery symbol. And that is the symbol that represents the teaching of the secret doctrine more so than any other symbol. Almost, actually, sometimes in theosophy, instead of having a point in the star, Blavatsky puts an ankh, which is a Egyptian symbol for life, like the life principle. So for Blavatsky, you have a Star of David and you have an ankh in the center. Okay, because of my zero-point studies, I usually put a point. Blavatsky also uses the form of the Star of David with a central point. And she ascribes great significance to this. So even in that book of Genesis, see there again, hey Jim, I mean to think there's the Star of David with the central point. In a way, you can extract that from the first few four verses of the book of Genesis.
Very interesting.
So, okay, so coming back then and the seven, okay, so, oh yeah, two, and the universe had yet to be outbreathed by that which is and yet is not. And that launched me off into talking about the ceaseless breath and how when creation happens, Blavatsky says, it's the Father's breath is hot. So Blavatsky explains, like, creation is highly energetic. And she talks about the darkness radiates light, and then she calls the light is cold flame, which generates flame and heat and motion and then moisture. So it's like there's this generation of elements that emerge out of this fundamental breath. Okay, the ceaseless breath is light, it generates light, and then heat and motion and production of material matters. So in creation, the hot breath of the Father leads to expansion of the universe. And then Blavatsky says, well, that goes on for a certain period of time, the outbreathing. And then over time, she says, there's a shift in the ceaseless breath, and the cool breath of the mother touches it. And so it's like this cool breath of the mother then withdraws the universe, and Blavatsky says, back to her bosom. Like it's like the divine mother ingathers the universe at the end of time into the divine bosom or the divine heart. That's beautiful, eh, Jim? Like this concept of these created universes, what Blavatsky would call a son or a pilgrim, who kind of comes out of nothingness and brought into, you know, it's like being kicked out of the Garden of Eden into the material world, but eventually returning again into the bosom of the Divine Mother.
Kicked out of the Garden of Eden.
I don't know, we had a beep there. I didn't know.
Do we have
some
caller?
Yes, this is Mark from Ohio.
Hi, Mark. Welcome.
Well, thank you. I had a few questions I wanted to throw out into the mix here to get your thoughts on. Some of the things that you guys are discussing reminds me of some of the lectures that I've heard Nassim Haramein give, and I wondered if you were familiar with his work at all.
A little bit, and I had John Francis and all your earlier caller directed me to his work, and he's a physicist, and this is fascinating. He is the only physicist who I believe, I understand he thinks that at the center of the sun is what he calls a white hole, black hole. So he believes that there's like a singularity point in the center of the sun. Okay, and he also claims that this generates a hexagonal form around this white hole, black hole. Okay. Now that a hexagonal form is like a three-dimensional embodiment of the Star of David. So essentially, as I understand his work, he's suggesting the sun has a zero-point center which generates a hexagonal form, which is like the embodiment of the Star of David in the subtle matters of the sun. I don't know if Mark is that. Would you agree with that as a reading of his work?
Yeah, you know, his lectures just have so much material in them. I've listened to them over and over and over again, and I remember him talking about what you just mentioned, but he also talks about the vacuum structure of the universe,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that each point contains an infinite amount of energy, and each mm-hmm. point contains an infinite amount of information. So
mm-hmm.
somehow finite systems and infinite systems are somehow complementary. And it's hard to wrap my mind around, but it seems like that you guys are kind of going on a parallel direction here.
Absolutely, Mark, I agree. And I've just started watching some of his videos, and when I produce this next copy of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, I'm hoping to mail him a copy, because he's someone who I can learn from, because it just further enriches the kind of perspective I've been developing. He's the only one. I mean, for me, the last couple of months I've been writing a lot about what Blavatsky calls the invisible sun. And she says that the real sun is this nucleus of primal matter, which is like the zero-point Leia center of the sun. Okay? And then from that, it generates the seven Daihan Chohan, which are the seven spiritual intelligences, or the seven Logi, that manifest the will of God through the mechanism of the sun. And that's symbolized by a Star of David. So the idea that he's kind of seeing this hexagonal structure in the sun, and he's also, I think, regarding other planets, may have zero-point centers. See, Blavatsky's saying that all what she calls self-moving planets, like planets with rotation, she's saying they have zero-point centers. Because it's the zero-point centers and the rotation that occurs within the zero-point centers that imparts the rotation to the planet.
So that's Blavatsky, like a black hole. A black
again,
hole at the center, so to speak?
Well, see, a white hole, black hole. See, when you have the manifestation from within, without, something appears as a white hole. But then when the cosmos withdraws without within, it disappears into a black hole. So the alpha point, the point of creation is a white hole, and the point of dissolution in the omega point is a black hole. And that's like that physicist you mentioned, how he said he calls the sun a white hole, black hole.
I see.
Also, the idea how he says that the vacuum, there's an infinite in information and intelligence within the vacuum, within empty space. And in the Secret Doctrine, this is what Blavatsky calls the fundamental proposition of the Secret Doctrine, is the undivided unity of creation. And she says there is one omniscience which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. Okay, so what this is saying is Blavatsky's saying, well, there's this omniscience that thrills throughout every finite point of the universe, which suggests, yes, there's infinite information and intelligence that permeates all of space. And then
so,
the zero point, the nothingness is
odd, is that omniscience that's actually embedded into the structure of the universe?
Yes.
Ah. You know, I also wanted to ask you guys another thought, and it kind of goes back to a little bit what you were talking about earlier. You know, I don't know if you've ever studied any of these ancient sites like Pumapunku in Bolivia. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Ah, well.
Slightly.
It's kind of like the pyramids. It's a great mystery. In Bolivia, 12,000 feet high on this mountain is are these giant ruins, and some of these stones are 400 tons, and they're made out of diorite, which is the hardest granite that there is. In fact, it's so hard that you can only cut it with a diamond-tipped blade or a laser beam. And, you know, a 400-ton stone, some of these 400-ton stones are stacked on top of each other, and there are grooves cut in them so they fit together. And with our largest cranes today, we can only lift a 200-ton stone. So, like you guys were saying, I think somewhere in the past, these ancient civilizations, probably before the flood, had knowledge of these concepts that you're discussing. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, I mean, Blavatsky's actually saying that these stanzas that I'm reading actually come down to us from these divine beings who pass them to the sons of light at the beginning of our round after Atlantis, the submersion of Atlantis. So she is saying that these are this higher spiritual knowledge that's been passed down to us.
You know, I've never believed that the Egyptians built the pyramids. In fact, the Egyptians, I think, say that the sun gods are the ones that taught them how to build those pyramids.
Yeah.
And it wasn't actually the Egyptians themselves that had that knowledge. So that's fascinating,
yeah.
Then. So you would agree that there was some great knowledge in the ancient past that we've somehow forgotten.
Yes, and different rounds. Oh, sorry. Different rounds. Blavatsky saw the Atlanteans as developing like a highly advanced knowledge. She also saw there as being earlier races of giants. Have you ever seen any of these pictures of the huge human skulls,
which
a man standing beside it is about a quarter the size of the skull? Have you seen pictures of these? Emerged out of the Middle East. Blavatsky says there were these races of giants, and she had other races earlier where there was genetic experimentation which produced all these kinds of monstrous beings, half animal and half human and other combinations. Blavatsky has a fascinating alternative history of humankind. So
don't you think then we really are just now learning what our real history is?
I believe it's another thing that we've been deceived about by the world elites who have not wanted humankind to know our true origins. And actually, I believe we as human beings actually are extraterrestrials in the sense that we come out of higher dimensional space and we come into the material forms, but the essential life principle within us, it's not produced by material phenomena. It comes down into us out of higher dimensional space. And that our bodies are formed from intelligences, like I would say the lunar Pritis, they help develop the astral body. But the solar intelligences, they develop the inner spiritual body. So a human being actually has different bodies that these different spiritual intelligences in the cosmos participate together to form the different bodies. Like there are lunar Pritis and there are solar Pritis and earth Pritis. So the creation of the body is like a complex of these intelligences and forces participating.
So there's the ruling elite, the globalists, then, from what you're saying, have knowledge of this ancient information, and it's been suppressed for a long, long time. And people
centuries.
Are now rediscovering that, I guess.
Yes, I think this is emerging into broader awareness that we've been deceived. I believe like the Darwinian evolutionary theory has been this grand hoax, and in a way it's been to demean human beings. They haven't wanted human beings to be spiritually empowered, and instead they want to demean us in every way possible. Like they tried, you know, through the Scientific Committee for the Investigations of the Claims of the Paranormal. They tried to invalidate any evidences for any psychical phenomena or any spiritual thing. and they try to denigrate religion and so on. I think it's been an intentional program to dummy down the human race so that we didn't realize our higher faculties.
I'll just say I completely disagree with that. So I have a very different understanding of things. But what I would say is that I don't know if you remember this, Chris, but you used to have this sticker that was, I forget where it was. I think it was in your van at one point, and it was a little cartoon, and it said something like, I think it was a bear, and it said, there's been an alarming increase in the number of things I know nothing about.
Yeah, a little Winnie the Pooh. It was a little Winnie the Pooh bear.
And I'm 60 years old, and I realize there's been an alarming increase in the number of things I know nothing about. The more you delve into these things, you have to work really hard to get this ignorant, you know? Like, I mean, you have to get this hard to be confronted with your own ignorance, I guess, is that you have to realize that there's a profound alternative to almost everything that we're taught in every level of society in terms of every level of education. And whether or not that's intentional, I don't really see it as being as intentional as you do, and I don't see it as being created by elites. I think it's more... Well, I think there are a variety of, it's a very complex topic. I mean, I think there are intentional aspects of things, and I think there are other things where people are just wrong about things. And then there's a great forgetting about our past. I think the idea that there have been civilizations before us where there have been highly developed and very sophisticated, technological and scientific developments, I think that's probably true, and that we know virtually nothing about this today, and that this is completely submerged, just as Atlantis is submerged. But as our caller, as Mark points out, there are so many examples. I wasn't aware of this site in Bolivia, but how, you know, something like that. How would you possibly move 400,000 pound granite stones with what kind of technology would have to be available to do that? That's quite amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah. There's even if you study the pyramids in detail, you quickly come to the point of view that a lot of the mainstream archaeologists really don't know how they were built. It's amazing, and I appreciate the show today, guys. I think it's very important. And thank you for bringing this information out, and I will listen off the air and have a good day.
Great.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mark. Yeah.
I just wanted to comment on one other thing that Mark was saying, and mm-hmm. Many years ago I read a fair amount about the pyramids and what he said about sun gods, and the Egyptians, you know, didn't say that they built them, that they got the information from the sun gods. There again, there's something that, you know, you can take on a literal thing and say, well, that was just them being superstitious, because, you know, the Egyptians worship the sun, eh? But what if they did get this knowledge from the sun gods, you know? Like, I mean, you could take that, but no, that's not metaphorical, that's literal, you know?
Yeah. And there's even another way in which we can see the sun gods are within ourselves. We'll come to the sun in our as we go through this three-part series. Yes. I'm going to explain some of Blavatsky's views about the origin of the solar system and the center of the sun and the fascinating material.
Well, before we go on, though, could you just I know this person that you were talking about with Mark. I know that John Francis had mentioned him, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Where his information? Do you have information where we can go and see his lectures online? Or
I can send you the link, and I'm not sure the pronunciation of his work. It's something like Carmine. Sorry, Jim.
Maybe for the next show, you could get some information, and we could just share it with the listeners. I would definitely be very interested, or maybe Mark can call in and tell us where we can see the lectures. You know.
Yeah, it was very exciting to me because I had just recently been writing a Blavatsky, like reviewing Blavatsky's understanding of the sun and the solar system, and then I come across him. He's the only one I've ever heard of suggesting the sun has a white hole, black hole center, and that there's a hexagonal, like a three-dimensional Star of David structure within the heart, and this is partly how it generates the kind of circulation of energies and on the sun and the life of the sun is tied into this, which is absolutely fascinating because it was like confirmation of what an idea. I've never heard anyone else. See, in modern science, no one thinks that cosmic bodies like the Earth or the Moon or the Sun or the planets have any kind of dynamic life center, a zero-point center. But that's what Blavatsky's saying. These cosmic bodies have zero-point centers, and it's through the means of that center in these cosmic bodies that the intelligences, the information sources, they bring life, inform that planet and the processes that occur in that planet. So it's a fascinating view in Blavatsky, and we'll come to, I'll discuss how Blavatsky didn't believe in the existence of gravity. She said gravity, that it doesn't really exist, it's an illusion. It's produced by variation of Fohat, which we'll come to. But she says what holds the planets together isn't gravity, but rather it's this underlying intelligence that informs the solar system as a whole and binds it. But we'll come to that. So coming back a little bit here, I think the last thing I was talking about is this idea of that the breath of the Father is upon the universe during the creation, and that is hot breath. And then eventually it shifts into the cool breath of the Mother, and that ingathers the universe again back to the heart of the Divine Mother. And we see in the stanzas of Zen, when it talks about when creation occurs, what happens is you have the darkness radiates one solitary beam of light, which penetrates into the heart of the Divine Mother. And that is what leads to the creation. The three fall into four, and that begins a pilgrimage of the fourth is the sun. And that begins a pilgrimage. So it's a light, a ray of light penetrating into the heart of the Divine Mother. So the idea is that creation initially originates out of the heart of the Divine Mother, and then the universe is eventually reabsorbed into the heart of the Divine Mother. And in Kabbalah, the Bina, which is the Divine Mother, that represents the heart. And the seven realms below, the seven worlds created out of the Divine Mother, are created out of the heart of the Divine Mother. So this is very important, is this mystical conception of the heart and the heart of the Divine Mother. And in the stanzas of Zen, it reads at one point, the suns expand and contract through their own selves and hearts. You see, we expand and contract through the heart. So that's a little bit then about the breath, the ceaseless breath, and how we begin with the breath of the Father is upon it, and eventually the breath of the Mother contracts and ingathers the universe. Now what this is suggesting, what Blavatsky's suggesting, is that it's not gravity that eventually collapses the universe back to a singularity point. It's not due to the effects of gravity. Meaning by that, when I say the effects of gravity, what I mean is the effects of mass or material particles upon each other that they accumulate because of gravity. See, Blavatsky doesn't believe in gravity in that way. Instead, she's saying that things adhere because of the how all things adhere within the Divine Mother. They're rooted into the heart, and things adhere because of this. And we'll see later, if I get to this, is how this corresponds with certain modern concepts emerging in the holographic paradigm in physics. But, see, Blavatsky, I would say, in terms of modern science, what Blavatsky's saying will collapse the universe at the end of time is a shift in the ceaseless breath which permeates hyperspace. So there's a shift in that breath which ingathers the universe. So it's not due to blind mass and the force of gravity, but rather there's this ingathering which is propagated as an effect through the ethers. But we'll come to this further in later shows. So to begin, what we have are these two primary characters in Blavatsky, the eternal parent space, which is the divine mother, and the ceaseless breath, which is the divine father, the spiritual principle. Okay, so going back to the stanzas, and we'll get through stanza one and a little bit more today. Number seven, the causes of existence had been done away with. The visible that was and the invisible that is rested in non-eternal non-being, the one being. Alone, the one form of existence, stretched, boundless, infinite, causeless, in dreamless sleep, and life pulsated unconscious in universal space throughout that all presence which is sensed by the opened eye of the dogma. The dogma is like an enlightened soul. So she's saying that an enlightened soul can sense this life pulsating unconscious in universal space. And the last verse of stanza one, but where was the dogma when the Eleia of the universe was in Paramatma and the great wheel was Anupadaka? And I don't want to get into explaining all those terms, but it's like everything rests in formlessness and non-being. So all of stanza one of the stanzas of Zand then is depicting what is existent in pre-existence before the universe is created. And we're trying to understand the root principles underlying the creation of a manifest universe. Any comments, Jim? That's the end of stanza one.
Wow.
It's hard to just jump in. There's so much.
No, I think you've explained it very well. Like it's difficult to it's a little bit difficult to extrapolate and even to explain this because there's so many tangential meanings that you know, and it's hard to reduce it all to something very essential.
Yeah.
But I think you've done it's a good job of introducing it. I mean, as you sort of articulate, because then you make an aside and say, well, you know, like Blavatsky didn't believe in gravity. Like, okay, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, you know, like, oh, something simple, good. There are so many complexities that in terms of elaborating it, but I think you've given a good overview of the first, you know, at the beginning stanzas and the meaning that you get a sense of, like, this is a very profoundly different kind of explanation of the nature of creation. But, I mean, the fact that what she's trying to do, she's trying to explain the nature of creation and not only the nature of creation, but its relationship to non-creation, you know? Like, I mean, it's not only that she's explaining the manifest physical universe, but also going back to beyond when it began. I mean, it's kind of incomprehensible on a certain level, but,
Exactly, yeah. It reminds me of a book, I think, by Paul Davies. It was called God and the Superforce, or no, the Superforce. I forget the name of the book, actually. In it, he talks about how everything kind of came out of nothingness, and he says, like, how incredible this is, and how it's like a convoluted, like, nothingness, like everything is kind of essentially nothingness. I mean, this is the main doctrine of Buddhism, is the essential nothingness of the voidness of everything. It's like an illusion out, but essentially everything kind of reduces to nothing, kind of. And then Davies kind of questions, well, could there be any patterns of existence pre-existent in non-existence?
Yeah, that's
and he raises that as a scientist asking, well, what could there be some kind of you know, pattern of existence, pre-existence, in non-existence.
Yeah.
It's like a Zen koan, eh?
Yeah,
what pattern of existence is pre-existent in non-existence? And Blavatsky's trying to answer that. That's what the stanzas are about. They're trying to address that. They're saying, well, there are the sevenfoldness of hyperspace is latent in non-being. And then what we come to is seven luminous lords are latent in non-being. And these are the Elohim, or the seven divine intelligences, who Blavatsky describes as sculpting the void. Like they begin to create form out of formlessness. Okay, so there's these, like, divine or spiritual intelligences. But she's saying also those seven luminous suns, they're also latent in non-being. The firstborn, according to esoteric teachings, are the seven luminous lords, the seven divine suns. But these are said not to be created. These are emanated because they already exist in pre-existence. The seven luminous lords are absorbed in non-being before creation happens. And when creation happens, the Elohim, or those seven luminous lords, are the first to emerge from the matrix of darkness and non-being, is how Blavatsky explains it. So that creates seven luminous lords, and those are seven divine intelligences. And then what we see in the spiritual teachings of the secret doctrine, the divine intelligences then create like a secondary level of spiritual intelligences associated in our solar system with the seven lords of the sun, the seven luminous lords. So those on a lower level then represent the solar logos, the intelligence embodied in the sun, and the sun is their body. So those seven spiritual logi in the sun, they derive on a higher level from the divine intelligences. So it's like this kind of stepping down process. And it's most useful to have a Kabbalistic concept of the structure of four world orders. There's a world emanated, created, formed, and the world made. And those represent the elements of fire, air, water, and earth. And it's just like I would say, human being, what is the human heart? Well, I would say there's four levels to the heart. Ultimately, there's a divine source emanation. Okay, the God spark within a human being, the eternal principle, the monad, okay, the jiva atma, the divine spark. But then that step down, and that creates a spiritual self, which could also be described as a spiritual spark because it's still beyond our level of perception. Okay, and then that spiritual heart, so I would say we have a spiritual heart. And then below that, we have a psychical heart, and that's related to our desire life and the astral plane and our passionate nature. And then we have a physical heart, which is the actual physical organ made of matter. So I would say there's four levels within the human heart of emanation, creation, formation, and the world made. So you have a divine source element, a spiritual heart, a psychical heart, and then a material heart. And these interpenetrate and sustain one another. So anyway, coming back to the stanzas then, what Blavatsky goes, the stanzas go on to say, is how these seven luminous lords are latent in non-being before creation happens. See, and everything in the secret doctrine is sevenfold. You see, the Divine Mother has the seven skins, and then when the Divine Father, represented by the ceaseless breath, there's seven modifications of the ceaseless breath, and those are the seven logi. Okay, so just continuing, I'll just read a couple more stanzas of stanza two, a couple more verses of stanza two, and then I'm going to leave it. It'll take us right up to the point where creation happens, and we'll pick up from there next time, drawing from the stanzas to describe the process of mystical creation. But stanza one then, stanza two, sorry, verse one, where were the builders, the luminous sons of Manvantaric dawn? Manvantaric means creation, like Manvantaric dawn means the dawning of a new day, a new cycle of creation. So she's saying, where are the builders, the luminous suns? Okay, and then she, in the unknown darkness, in their ahi paranishpana, which is in their blissful kind of celestial realm, the producers of form from no form, the root of the world. They rested in the bliss of non-being. Excuse me. Where was silence? Where were the ears to sense it? No, there was neither silence nor sound, not save the ceaseless eternal breath, which knows itself not. The hour had not yet struck. The ray had not yet flashed into the germ. Okay, and the ray would be the original ray of light, which is emerges out of the darkness. Okay, and it hasn't flashed into the germ. The Matri Padma had not yet swollen. The mother flower, the mother lotus had not yet swollen. Her heart had not yet opened for the ray, one ray to enter, hence to fall as three into four, into the lap of Maya. I love that expression, Jim, the way she talks about how the three fall into four.
Yeah.
You know, you have like that and the parent space and the ceaseless breath, and those three, the threefoldness of the absolute, produce the fourth, which is the sun. And so the three fall into four.
Yeah. Well,
okay. I'll just finish stanza two because it's almost done here. The seven suns were not yet born from the web of light. Darkness alone was father, mother. These two are the germ, and the germ is one. The universe was still concealed in the divine thought and the divine bosom. So here we have other terms for like the divine thought and the divine bosom. Again, are references to the divine father and mother principles. The divine thought is related to the ceaseless breath, and the divine bosom is related to the heart space of the divine mother. So in the first two stanzas of Zan, then, what it depicts is the nature of existence, pre-existence to the emergence of a cosmos. So it's trying to look at the root principles of creation. And what I've been trying to do is explain how these essentially have counterparts in modern concepts. And the eternal parent is a seven-dimensional hyperspace. That's what Blavatsky's claiming. There's a seven-dimensional hyperspace, and when worlds are created out of that, it creates seven planes of existence, and then each again of those is sevenfold. So this talk sometimes about there being 49 fires. Okay, it's all modeled in the structure of a piano keyboard of seven octaves, 49 notes, and then a 50th note, which is the ultimate culmination of the piano keyboard. So this concept of 7x7 cosmos is all depicted in the structure of a piano keyboard, which is, Gurdjieff says, was designed specifically to pass esoteric knowledge down through the generations. Okay, so, well, that's good, Jim. That's a good start to this attempt to elaborate the mystical creation. We got through the first two stanzas, so we're ready to, next time we'll have a random quantum fluctuation.
creation, here we come.
Yeah.
Yeah. It always kills me is like, then the random quantum fluctuation, but nobody was there to observe it. So how does anybody know it was random? It was completely absurd, you know? Like, I mean, anyway, that was very good.
Yeah, it's a fascinating book, and it'll be fun to do two more shows on this and try to develop a bit deeper understanding of it. It's amazing to have this forum, and I so value BBS. It's like people don't have access to this advanced mystical kind of knowledge very much, and I think it's just so important. We need to have a re-enchantment of the cosmos, yeah. As some authors talk about. Like it's like modern science. They think everything is just matter. Not Blavatsky calls it the modern triad of a non-sentient matter, senseless force, and blind chance.
Yeah.
That's
By
what
the way,
he calls the holy trinity of modern science. Which is brilliant, eh?
We've reached the big crunch, you know, we're out of time.
We reached a big crunch. Okay, so, well, I would encourage people, please visit my website at zeropoint.ca. You can order the book, The Heart Doctrine, through Amazon, anywhere throughout North America. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll pick up on part two of Mystical Creation on The Secret Doctrine. Thanks very much to James Moffitt from Toronto, Ontario. Any final words, Jim?
No, that was great. Thanks. And we'll continue in 2 weeks.
Yeah, good. Okay,
great.
Thank you, BBS.
Thanks.
Take care, all.
Yeah, bye-bye. Thanks, Doug and Don. Bye.